Welcome to Grow Your Influence, leadership conversations for business owners and managers. Whether you own a business and have a team, or leadership is part of your role, welcome, you're exactly where you need to be. Join co-hosts Juliette Robinson and Christy Lee Billett for their regular conversations on all things leadership. No corporate jargon, no textbook ideologies, just real life experience unpacked in a relaxed way to help you be your best boss and lead your team with confidence, clarity, and control. This is Grow Your Influence. Let's dive in. Hey there, it's Christy Lee here. Welcome to the summer series episodes of the Grow Your Influence podcast. Great to have you with us today. In today's summer series, Juliette is having a great conversation with Mel Kettle, who is the author of Fully Connected. Now, Fully Connected is a great book which helps leaders to prioritize themselves and reclaim their energy and find their joy. A great book if you're feeling exhausted and overwhelmed, feel like you have no time for yourself. And I'll tell you what, at this time of year, I feel like that could not be more true for many leaders amongst us and really wanting to regain their energy. Being a leader, as Mel says, in today's world is hard and we are pulled in different directions. We've got such varied responsibilities, both within business and in our lives. And it's really tricky to prioritize that looking after yourself piece. I know it's something that I am back on board with, but have had a little wobble with in the last 12 months. So a really great conversation that Juliette has had with Mel. We really appreciate Mel's time in joining us on the podcast to discuss her book and obviously her philosophy about helping leaders to better look after themselves and find that energy back again. So without further ado, let's jump into Juliette's conversation with Mel Kettle, author of Fully Connected.
Hi there, and welcome to the next in our summer series of interviews with people who have really interesting and important things to say about leadership and I think can really help us think about things in different ways. Today I'm talking with Mel Kettle about her recent book, Fully Connected, How Great Leaders Prioritize Themselves, Reclaim Their Energy and Find Joy. And I love that title for a start, Mel.
Oh, thank you.
Mel is an internationally recognized thought leader on fully connected leadership and communication. And she mentors executives and leaders. And she also speaks often, I think, at conferences and works as a trainer with teams. So she's working with people across a broad spectrum of industries and roles and has a lot of insight into these sorts of issues. At the heart of everything, Mel really has a commitment to self-leadership and an overarching belief that we need to lead ourselves. And I couldn't agree more. So that's why I really wanted to talk to Mel about these issues. And I know Mel has had some issues that caused her to sort of focus on this aspect of leadership, of being able to lead ourselves. And I really wanted to sort of dig into some of that as well, Mel. So thank you for joining us. And let's get into it.
Thanks so much, Juliette. Sorry, I've just noticed there's lots of background noise here. So I've just had to send a frantic text to my husband to say, shush.
Could you not? Don't worry. I find podcast episodes often interrupted with sort of dogs barking in the background at our house too, which is just, something you can't control. Don't worry.
It's going to work soon. So.
So Fully Connected, you talk about how we overschedule, we overcommit, we overwhelm ourselves.
Yeah.
I'd love to know, how did you come to the realisation that that's what we're doing and the impact it was having on your life?
So I burnt out fairly spectacularly in my late 20s. And when I reflected back on that, I realised it was because I didn't have a whole lot of self-awareness. I didn't have an understanding around what I needed to be doing in terms of self-care. And I also didn't have boundaries in place. So I was a yes girl. Everybody, whenever I was asked to do anything, I was like, yeah, sure. And so I've realized as I've gotten older that if I want to live a long and healthy life with, happiness and joy and with people I love around me, that I needed to be prioritizing what I wanted and what was important for me. And I was seeing that. So I've known that for a long time. And then when I was working with leaders and teams, I was working with a lot of communication and marketing teams. probably about 4, 5, 6 years ago. And one of the overwhelming things I was noticing is that they were all exhausted and they were all feeling really overwhelmed. They were overworked. They had a lot of things to achieve with, you know, not a lot of money, always not enough people. Yeah. And so I realized, okay, that's hasn't changed, because my burnout phase was when I was doing an event management role, but a lot of that was communication. And I was just thinking, wow, why are we still behaving in this way 20 years after I burned out? Why have workplaces really not improved that much? And why are we not recognizing as leaders and as individuals what we need to be doing to look after ourselves? And why are we not providing that support to our team and to our workforce and to our people? And so it took a long time for me to realize that this was the book I wanted to write, because I did a lot of, who am I to write a book like this? but I'm really glad I did, because it's had a positive impact on heaps of people.
I'm sure. In the book, you talk about the need to connect with yourself before you can look after yourself, which I think is a really interesting concept. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I feel that we are so busy in the world today, and that we forget that, you know, who we are, what are our values, what are our priorities, what are the things that are important to us, and what do we need to be doing for ourselves so that we can show up as better people for others. And whether it's as a leader or a manager at work, or whether it's as a parent or a friend or a sibling or an aunt or an uncle, what do we need to be doing so that when people come to us, and or when we're with other people, we are our true selves, which is, you know, 99% of the time, people who are kind and generous and thoughtful and who really do want to listen. But we so often get caught up in our own, you know, world and space that we forget about those things. And so when we take the time to reflect about who we are and what we want, then that's allowing us to better connect with who we really are.
And I agree. I think it's really hard to do, isn't it? I think it takes time and space and some awareness that's required. It also takes a bit of courage, I think, doesn't it?
They're definitely not easy conversations to have with yourself. No. And it does take courage, because having that time, creating the time and space to think and reflect is something that is difficult for most of us, because we have, you know, busy lives where we, and busyness is often a way of making ourselves feel important, let's face it. But we have addictions to our technology, to our phones, to email. We feel that we need to be always on and always present for other people, forgetting that we need to be on and present for ourselves. And so finding that time and space can be really difficult. But then asking yourself the difficult questions of, who am I? What do I want from life? Am I happy in the life that I'm currently living? They're really confronting. And it can be really difficult to ask ourselves those questions and then actually think about what do we really want, and then make the changes necessary to live the life that we want.
It, absolutely. I was interested when you talk about prioritizing yourself. In the book, you start with self-awareness. And this is always where I start when I'm working with leaders and talking about how we understand how we work and how we connect with others, how we build empathy, all of those sorts of things. How well do you think self-awareness is understood? I think it gets bandied around as a term a lot.
I feel that most people don't understand self-awareness. And I also know that, you know, from my experience and also from reading some research, particularly reading Tasha Urich's excellent book Insight, that most people think they have a high level of self-awareness, but the research shows that most people don't. And you know, for me, self-awareness is not only having a clear understanding of my values, my priorities, my healthy boundaries, my how I behave and why I behave the way that I do, but self-awareness is also having a deep understanding of how other people see you and perceive you. And I know that we will all have people in our lives who think that they are just the greatest thing since sliced bread, but the reality couldn't be further from the truth.
I think that's so interesting. I read recently about a study, and I think it was done back in about 2017, where they found 90% of the people surveyed felt they had great self-awareness, and 10 to 15% of their peers felt the same way about them, you know, that they, what they perceived was a real lack of self-awareness. So I think you're right. I think we imagine that we're really self-aware, and in fact, we're just seeing what we want to see.
Yeah. And I give an example in my book about that with a manager I used to work with who really thought he was just God's gift on every single level. And people just feared going into his office for conversations, knowing that he would, you know, deflect blame from anything that he was meant to do onto other people. And he was one of those people you just couldn't give bad news to, because he would find somebody else to blame for it. And at the end of the day, he was the man in charge and the buck should have stopped with him, but he refused to acknowledge that.
And I think we have probably all met or worked with somebody like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And or live with somebody like that. Well, I've got friends who live with people like that, who always say, it's all your fault that it's gone wrong.
Yes.
It wouldn't have happened had you not done, you know, some little teeny weeny thing or some big thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe that's true sometimes, but a lot of the time it's not.
And they talk about self-awareness in leadership in terms of this need to look in the mirror rather than look out to the team. And I think that's hard.
It is hard, but if you are always looking, like I think that it needs to be a bit of both, because one of the things with the whole looking in the mirror is we often expect other people to reflect our values and our beliefs.
Sure.
And,
yes.
You know, I remember very early on in my career when I was hiring someone for one of the first times, my boss said to me, just be really careful that you don't hire somebody who's just like you.
Yes, because that's so our tempting, default
bias. Isn't it? That's what we are, you know, predetermined to usually do.
Yes.
And I thought, oh God, okay, I'll try really hard not to. And I did end up going polar opposite. I couldn't have found someone more different to me if I tried. I think the only similarities, we were both women,
right?
And we were both in our 20s, and they were probably the only two similarities between us. We looked different. We behaved differently. We thought differently. We were at different stages in our life, even though we were practically the same age. I was single, she was about to get married. We had different experiences, which turned out to be very complementary, but it was a lot of butting heads to get to that point. And I remember thinking, yeah, okay, she was a really good hire, but now the really hard work has to begin for both of us, because we need to figure out how do we work together, because we were co-leaders of the team. How do we work together so that we are seen together to be a force?
And I think that's the real challenge, and that's where self-awareness comes in, isn't it? This understanding that if we know how we like to work and how we like to be, we're less likely to look at people who are different as annoying and more as just different from us.
Yeah.
And therefore, I agree. You know, need to connect.
Yeah, I agree. But I think that also when we look at ourselves and who we are, we're much more likely to have an understanding of that not everybody is like us and not everybody wants to work the way we do and communicate the way that we do. So, you know, questions that we should always be asking, particularly when we meet, when we get a new colleague at work or when we get a new client, is what's your communication preference? How do you want me to get in touch with you? Do you want me to email you, text you, phone you, message you on Instagram? Like what do you like? How often do you want to have meetings? How often do you like to have conversations? How much guidance do you need from me? Rather than just assuming that everybody's the same.
And I think that probably needs to be an ongoing conversation too, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, it really does. Yeah, it really does. And then also saying, this is my preference.
Yes, exactly.
What I like.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm really clear with my clients about how they can and can't communicate with me if they want a quick result. And at the end of the day, they can, you know, email, text, Instagram message, I don't really care. But if they want me to respond in a timely manner, then don't leave me a voicemail, send me a text message.
Right. Yes.
And There's certain, and I've got really clear boundaries around the times of day that I answer my phone, the times of day that my phone is not in do not disturb mode, the times of day when I'm available for conversations. And I make that really clear to everyone I work with very early on so that they can't get cranky if they ring me at 7 o'clock in the morning and I don't answer the phone.
Well, and I think that's an interesting one. And I think boundaries are part of our self-care, and self-awareness lets us set some boundaries.
I think boundaries are the most important thing when it comes to self-care, because when you have healthy boundaries in place, then you are more likely to prioritize things like exercise, grocery shopping and buying healthy food, cooking the healthy food and eating it. You're much more inclined to have an awareness of how long you're spending scrolling through Instagram or TikTok on your phone. You're much more likely to be aware of how many hours you're binge watching on Netflix and what time you're, and the impact that's having on the time that you go to bed. You're much more likely to be setting limits with people who are not your people. And it all of those things together contribute to stronger physical health and emotional health and mental health. And when we have healthy boundaries in place, we're much more inclined to cope when something goes wrong that we have no control over.
And I think setting boundaries can be difficult. You know,
So difficult.
Yes. I think they're easy to talk about, but most of the time we don't even think of them as boundaries.
Yeah, that's right. I've got a short course that I've recently launched on creating, communicating and keeping healthy boundaries. And the first thing I say is it's really difficult. And I run through all of the different types of boundaries that we need to have in our lives. And I just say, look, here's an exercise you can do to work out where you need them and then pick one. Start with one. Make one, you know, small change to begin with, and, you know, pick the one thing that's going to have the biggest impact on your life, but the smallest change to do that. And the example I give is, for me, about 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, I realized that I needed to be much more focused on my sleep. And so I put some boundaries around what did that look like for me, or some, you know, some desires around what does a good night's sleep look like for me. And it looks like 7.5 to 8 hours sleep, which meant that I had to change my bedtime from midnight to about 9:30, because I just wasn't getting sleep. And so that meant that I had to put boundaries around how many nights a week do I go out? How many hours of Netflix can I watch at night? What time do I turn the TV off? What time do I go to bed? What does my evening routine look like to set me up for an early bed so that I can get 8 hours sleep? And then how do I ensure I do that on a regular basis?
And I think that's it. It's holding that and actually honouring yourself once you've decided that's what's important.
Exactly.
You know, in the book you talk about sort of looking, you know, that self-action, that sort of taking action to look after yourself, because only we can do this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And that, which comes back down to as well, having a really clear awareness of what do you have control over in your life?
Yes.
Because there's so many things in life we can't control, but there is, and a lot of people focus on that, but there's so much we do have control over. And we can have, and, you know, one of those things is what time you go to bed. If you've got young children or if you're going through perimenopause, then you'll possibly have a bit less control over how many hours sleep you get and how many times you wake up in the night. But there's ways you can mitigate some of those things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But only you can do it. And I know as the parent of a teenager, others can't tell you when it's time to go to bed or how you need to look after yourself. I think these are things we have to come to ourselves.
Oh, exactly. It's like any big change. You need to come to the realization yourself that this is what's important to you. I look at one of my friends who recently lost an enormous amount of weight, and he had one of the surgical procedures to help him with that. And he said, I really wish I'd done it years and years ago, but the time, I wasn't mentally ready. I didn't recognize the importance of it. And it's now that, you know, things in life have changed that I've realized I really do want to live a long and healthy life. And one of the things that's preventing me from doing that is how much weight I'm carrying around. And so he made, you know, very lots of self-awareness decisions, lots of hard decisions, lots of self-reflection. And it's changed his life hugely. And not only from a physical health perspective and reducing the likelihood of him getting a whole heap of different diseases, but he said, I had no idea how much happier I would be and how much of my self-worth or lack of self-worth was tied up because of how I believed I looked. And he said, from a health perspective, it didn't matter how many people told him that he would be better off if he wasn't carrying around as much weight. He needed to come to that realization himself.
And we do, yes.
And it's like that with everything, you know, the sleep you get, the people you hang around with, the every aspect of your life.
Do you find having, you've written the book, but having established these things for yourself in terms of your self-care, do you find it hard to keep them in line, to hold on to them? I'm great at sort of writing the plan, but I'm often not terribly good at following it in the long term.
I really did not think that I would follow the sleep routine that I have been, because I was a night owl. But I'm really shocked by how much I have. And the reason I have is because I just feel so much better. I feel so much healthier. I have so much more energy. I get so much more done in the day because I'm not yawning my head off at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I don't have the brain fog that comes from not getting enough sleep.
Yeah.
And so it's because I feel so great that I'm happy to continue doing it. And, you know, I'm traveling this week and I know that I'll have quite a few late nights and not enough sleep. And I know I'll get home next weekend and think, God, I should have made better decisions. I'm really noticing the impact of not enough sleep.
Yes. And it's interesting how quickly that can happen as well.
It doesn't take much. It doesn't take much.
I think I talk to lots of people who say things like, oh, I so need to do this. I just don't have the time to get my head around it or the energy to, you know, focus on what I need to do.
Yeah.
What's your advice for them, Mel?
The only person who can change that is you. And so my advice is, you know, take a long, hard look at what is it that you do really want and work out how will you feel when you have that. So there's some fairly new research that's come out that says SMART goals are great, but if we attach an emotion to how we're going to feel or how we want to feel after we have achieved the thing, and we constantly remind ourselves of that emotion that we want to feel, then we're much more likely to achieve our goal. And so, you know, think about what is it that you really want to be doing. And again, sometimes it's just really small steps. Sometimes it's, but you know, you'll need to make a decision about what you want.
I think it's so true. Often when I do planning sessions with teams and we talk about SMART goals, I do end that session with talking about how are you going to feel? What are you, the people who know and love you, going to be saying about you in 6 or 12 months' time? You know, are they going to say, oh, you're so burnt out, or I haven't seen you for the last year? Or are they going to be saying, I love this new way of working where you're home in time to put the kids to bed, or we actually get to go on those date nights we talked about, you know? So thinking about what other people are seeing and saying can be a motivator, I think, as well. But you're right. That sense, that feeling is the thing that drives us, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
We know how we want to feel.
And emotions drive everything we do, whether we want to believe that or not. And so surely you would like, or don't you want positive emotions to be driving your decisions rather than the negative just-in-time emotions? And don't you want to have, you know, positive energy and feel like you're thriving? Or do you enjoy being in that stuck space or that survival space?
Yes.
People do because they can then be the martyr and say, oh, but I'm so busy and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, if you're recognizing any of that in you, think about, do I really enjoy that?
Is
And
this
if I do,
really
what
where I
do
want
I
to be?
enjoy about it? Is it really where I want to be? We've only got one life. Is that the way you really want to live it?
And look, I think if you are in that space, I can thoroughly recommend Mel's book,
Oh, thank you.
Fully Connected. I think, and it's available on your website, Mel.
Yes, it is, melkettle.com.
Yes, melkettle.com. It's great. It's a great book. And it's a really good starting point, I think. If this conversation resonates with you and you're thinking, I need to do something in the new year, then this could be a really good way to help you get started. Mel, going into the new year, what are some of the things you would recommend to, you know, to help leaders and their teams get through the end of the year without burning out, without stress, without this sense of my life's a bit out of control?
Yeah, look, I think the end of the year always has these self-imposed deadlines put on that we put on ourselves. And do you really need to? I know I'm just looking at my end of year. I'm planning on finishing up on the 15th of December, and we're recording this on the 27th of November. I'm running 8 masterclasses between now and then. I'm away for 11 days. And I'm away for 11 days and not doing any masterclasses in those 11 days. And I'm looking at my calendar going, do I need to do them all? A couple of them
what
I
can I
haven't
drop,
promoted.
basically?
What can I drop?
Yes.
Or not even what can I drop? What can I just move until next year? What really needs to happen this year and what can be done next year? And what are the, like I was sitting down this morning thinking, right, what are the mission critical things that I really do need to do this week? And I've just had that unpleasant realization that my BAS is overdue. And so that is a mission critical thing that needs to be done this week.
The really uninteresting thing that needs
to
be done.
I know, the boring thing. I've
marked
down to do that this afternoon.
I'm fascinated, though. Often I find towards the end of the year people who I haven't seen all year, so we must catch up before Christmas.
Yeah.
And it just creates this added stress of trying to find a time to catch up, where it makes so much more sense to try and do that, I find, in January, where everyone's a bit relaxed and we're not trying to juggle a million things and, you know, clear the decks.
Yeah, I totally agree. We always have a Christmas drinks with our neighbours in December, and we had the conversation about 3 weeks ago about when we would have it, and we did not have a free weekend until the 23rd and 24th of December. Because of other commitments and because I'm away for a few weekends and because of, you know, family celebrations for big birthdays. And so I just said to Sean, let's just do it at the end of January.
Let's take the
great
pressure
idea.
Off.
Great idea. So I'm not even thinking about it. I won't even think about it until probably the 3rd or 4th of January. And I know that then also most of our neighbours will be able to come because it won't be like it's been in previous years of I've already got 5 things on that night.
Yes. Well, that's it. And you're racing from thing to thing or you're feeling like you're letting somebody down or doing it in a half-assed sort of way.
Pick the one thing. You know, this weekend is a good example for us. We were in Brisbane. I had on Saturday for a 50th, and there were 3 other things that we could have done on that Saturday. And, you know, I thought about, do we try and fit this thing in and this thing in? And I just went, no. Family 50th, number one priority. It's the only priority for the day.
I think also as a team, resisting that impulse to sort of get it off your desk and onto someone else's just for the sake of doing that.
Exactly. And conversations you should be having at work with your team are things like, what are we doing? What do we need to get done this year? And what can we delay until next year? What can we, you know, what can we delete? What can we just even go, no, we don't need that? And then next year, when the year begins, in your first team meeting, you should be having conversations around what are our priorities as a team for this year? And how does that fit in with the organizational goals and objectives? Like how does our work fit in with what the organization has, expects, and what's realistic? What's realistic in terms of the amount of money that we can spend and then amount of people who we have and our general energy levels? Like, what do we want to get out of this year? And critically, how do we want to feel in December? How do we want to feel as a team in December? And one of the things that I always say to my clients is January is, well, actually November, December, but this will be out a bit later. So January is a really good time to encourage all of your team to book their annual leave into your organizational calendar for the year ahead.
Yes.
To make sure that people get it.
Yes.
And, you know, just because it's booked in, they can change it if they need to, presumably they should be able to. But make sure that everybody has an opportunity to have leave.
Yes.
Whether it's 1 week, 2 weeks, or 4 weeks. Yeah.
Yes. And they're thinking about when they're going to take breaks and.
Yeah, exactly. You know, exactly.
Have things to look forward to in that sense as well.
Exactly. Because when we have things to look forward to, we are far more easily able to get through the challenging times. And, you know, every workplace has its difficulties and its challenges. But if you know that you're going on holidays, you know, in three weeks' time, then that'll give you the momentum to push through that.
Yes. No, I think that's very true. And I think as leaders, we have a responsibility to lead these conversations.
Yeah, we do.
And I think some of that is this idea that we do need to talk about overwhelm and burnout from our own perspective and how we're managing it and the boundaries we want to put in place and make it safe for our teams to do the same.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, organizations have built-in boundaries through things like an operational plan, a strategic plan, policies and procedures. They're all guidelines that form the boundaries within your organization. My question for your listeners is, if you're responsible for managing those and making sure that they are adhered to, what happens when they're not?
Yes.
If your work hours, for example, are 8:30 to 5 with an hour off for lunch, what happens if your staff don't get that? What happens, like, is that the expectation and is that what happens? Or is there this unwritten culture in your organization that you start early, stay late, work through lunch? Do you have policies around emails and Zoom meetings and when people are expected into the office? And how do you, what are the consequences of those not being adhered to? And how do you make sure that people know what those policies and procedures are and whether they are right? Like one of my friends said to me last year, she said, I've got a new job and I thought it would be great. But what I didn't realize, because they didn't tell me as a part of the recruitment process and I didn't think to ask the question, is that every second weekend we're expected to do a bit of work.
Wow.
And I'm just like, right, okay, so that's not fair. And it wasn't so much that they were expected to, but it's that their workloads were so great that she couldn't get away without doing it because of the volumes of meetings.
And that had become the culture in the team. Yeah.
Another friend of mine got a job at a consulting firm and she was told, and one of the reasons she took it, and I laughed my head off when she told me this, was because she wanted to have more balance in her life. And it was exactly.
Right, yes.
Was that one of the big four?
Consulting firms,
was that one of the big four? I laughed my head off. And she's got two little kids and she's like, I just need a bit of balance. And I said, are you sure that this is the right decision? And she said, yeah, they've told me that I only need to do, you know, 35 hours a week. And I went, okay. A couple of months in, I said, how's it going? And she said, yeah, what they didn't tell me was it was 35 hours of billable a week.
Yes.
And so there's all of this training that they expect me to do.
Yes.
And there's all of this admin that they expect me to do. And that's on top of the 35 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't make that clear. And so now I don't, like, now it's just hell. And now what do I do?
And I think there's that, the social contract, the psychological contract between people and their boss gets broken almost instantly.
Oh, yeah.
When you realize that.
It does.
There's this sense of being conned almost. And it's really hard to then put up boundaries because you feel like you've been clear about your needs.
Yeah.
And this comes at you, particularly when you're new.
Oh, yeah. And particularly when you haven't, you go in with an expectation based on what you've been told.
Yes.
I've got another colleague who consulted with a firm a few years ago and then she got a fairly senior job with them a couple of years later. So she had an awareness of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason she said yes to the job was because of the person she'd be reporting to. he didn't tell her until her first day that he was moving to another country because they'd relocated him and promoted him. And he had known about it for months.
Right.
And she said, I just felt like he lied to me and
yes.
lied by omission.
Yeah.
Because if I knew that he wasn't going to be my boss, I was going to have to work with this other person
mm-hmm.
who I really struggled with, I would have said no.
Mm.
And he knew that, so he didn't tell me.
Mm.
She said, I just feel cheated. And I thought, that yes. is not a good start to this job.
No,
not
no. And I think that's the thing. Let's not be those leaders. I have a friend in the UK who's just started a graduate job with the NHS, and it comes with a master's degree in that you spend your weekends studying for a master's. So you're working full time, you're studying on the weekend. Now, the upside is they're paying for you to do your master's. The downside is there's no break ever.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a job years ago when I really wanted to go back to uni and do my master's, and I said to my boss, what support will I get? And he said, oh, we'll pay for it. Like, we'll pay, well, they would have paid for three quarters of it. And I said, great. What about time off?
What time?
I was working 80 hours a week, and he said, no, we won't give you time off. And I went, well, then I won't do it.
Yes.
What's the point?
Yeah.
I'm too exhausted as it is. So.
Well, that's self-care, isn't it? And, you know, that's understanding that actually that's not going to be possible.
No, and I did end up doing it a few years later with a different employer.
Yeah.
And they paid for between half and three quarters of each subject, depending on what the subject was, which was fantastic. But they also gave me, I think they gave me 3 days of study leave a term, or it might have been 2 days per subject of study leave a term.
Yeah.
Which was fantastic. And it wasn't a lot, but it was an acknowledgement.
Yeah.
And that made a massive difference to my willingness to stay in that job. I stayed in that job for a little bit longer than I probably should have, but I knew that they were supporting my studies because it benefited them hugely.
Right.
But it also, they were supporting me in a way that really did benefit me as well.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
you know, we need to think about, what is it that we want from our people? Most organizations expect a lot from their staff and their workforce. What are you giving back? It's got to be a two-way thing. And it's not just, as one of my former managers said to me, I pay you, why should I thank you?
Oh, God.
I didn't stay there very long.
Why should I thank
you?
Actually, you reminded me, I have heard that from somebody else. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're doing their job. Why do I have to constantly thank them for doing their job?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so what are the benefits for the people that you are hiring? Why should they work with you?
Yes.
Why should they work in your team for your organization, doing the work that you get them to do? What are the benefits of that? Because money alone isn't going to cut it these days. And if you don't allow them to take the time and what they need to prioritize and focus on their time management, their energy and their attention, then you're not going to keep good people.
And I think that's a really interesting segue into the generational differences.
Oh, yes.
Because I think there's a generation coming through who will not put up with this, you know, long, long hours, no consideration of self-care, basically, and of the need to have a life. What are you seeing?
Oh, I'm seeing exactly that. I'm seeing exactly that. And I really love the generation that's coming up now because they are so confident in talking about what's important to them and what they want and what they expect. And I really wish that I had had that confidence, you know, in my first
oh, God,
10
too.
Or 12 years of life. And even when I've had difficult clients, you know, as a consultant in my 40s in particular, where I just sat back and sucked it up.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I should have been firmer around my expectations, and we should have had more conversations around our mutual expectations.
Yeah.
So that we didn't have the tears, usually mine, that came.
Yes, or the burnout. I mean, this is where burnout happens because we don't feel able to say it. And I am delighted that this generation coming through, what I see is that they will say, that's actually, I can't do that because I've got stuff on in my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or, you know, that just doesn't seem feasible or possible.
So long as we don't go the other way where they only want to do what they want to do and not what's needed.
Sure. Yeah.
But
absolutely.
Again, I feel that that is less likely to happen when we have open and honest conversations from even before people join an organization.
Yes.
You know, you need to have these conversations as a part of your recruitment process. What do you really expect? And one of the things that I, you know, again, reflecting back on jobs that I said yes to and didn't say yes to, and that were, you know, good ones and awful ones, is I really wish I'd said, are there people in the, who else in the organization can I talk to?
Yes.
You're getting reference checks from me.
Yeah.
Who can I talk to get reference checks about what the culture's like here? Who will give me honest feedback? Can I sit in your staff room for half an hour one lunchtime and just chat to people and say, I'm thinking of coming to work here. What's it really like? Does anybody in the lunchroom, or do they all sit at their desks and eat through lunch, work through lunch?
And I think, you might be able to ask that now. I think that would have been seen as very confronting, probably until even, you know, maybe 5 years ago. Although we talk about that idea of culture matching and of making sure that we're a good fit, not just that the organisation thinks we're a good fit, I think that would be very confronting for most organisations if you said, can I come in and have a little bit of a nose around?
I think it would be as well. But now we've got tools like we've got Glassdoor where you can go onto Glassdoor and see what do people really think.
Yes.
Or we've got LinkedIn where you can look at who is in LinkedIn, who are my connections in that organization?
Yeah.
Who are my second connections in that organization? Who can I get an introduction to?
Yes.
Who's doing the job already? Who's, you know, in the team that I'll be moving into? Who can I have a conversation with? And employers need to realize that there's a lot of people having those conversations that they may not be aware of,
and that we can circumvent this system using social media.
Absolutely.
I think, and as you say, things like Glassdoor, these online reviews where anybody can post about their job or their employer.
Exactly.
I think that's so important. So, Mel, do you feel like you've got it right? Do you feel like you've got the balance right in terms of, you know, that self-awareness, that self-connection, that looking after yourself?
For me personally? Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I do. But I've put a lot of effort into it.
And
I really feel that for me personally, we moved from Brisbane to the Sunshine Coast nearly 3 years ago, and that was the game changer for me. That allowed me to it changed my mindset. It's a very different lifestyle up here to even in Brisbane, which was very laid back compared to Sydney. But I'm also in a different financial position now to what I was in my 20s and 30s. So I don't need to make decisions, work-related decisions, based on money to the same extent that I used to. You know, I took jobs in my 30s that I just desperately didn't want, but I needed to pay a mortgage.
When I
bought my first house, 60% of my take-home pay went to pay the mortgage. And I had that first year interest rate of, it was 4%. In my second year, I knew it was going up to about 5.8%. And I knew to be able to pay the difference in the mortgage repayments, I had to get a higher paying job that paid me at least $20,000 more a year. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to pay the mortgage.
Yeah, you're making those decisions based on financial considerations, not on what you need from the role or where you want to be.
Exactly. And, you know, financial stress is something that a lot of people make decisions around because of financial stress. And I see it a lot, and I don't have a solution other than maybe, you know, again, talk to the relevant people that can help you reduce some of that financial stress, whether it's a bank or your energy providers or your landlord if you're renting. Doing courses, like there's so many courses now, like Melissa Brown has a great course called Your Financial Adulting Life. So looking at some of those and thinking, what can I do differently?
Look, I think that is so true, and perhaps it comes back around to self-awareness, to deciding what's important.
Yeah, it does.
You know, do we need to live here, have these things, whatever it is, but make some of those decisions based on what's important to you, not what you're trying to sort of project in the world potentially.
We made those big decisions a few years ago when my husband decided that he didn't want to be an accountant anymore. And now he works for Coles, and he went from earning a lot of money to minimum wage with a part-time job. And so we talked about that for a long time before he made that decision. And we talked about things like, what's our current financial situation? What are we spending money on?
Yes.
What does my income look like? Can I increase my income to offset some of his loss of income? Yeah. And where do we spend money that we just don't need to?
Mm.
And so, you know, we were, and one of the things was, do we need to stay in this house? Could we sell our house and move somewhere smaller? But with the real estate market at the time, that was just not, like, that was going to cost us more money because of, you know, by the time you take in stamp duty and the cost of buying and selling, that was a decision that didn't make sense, which I was happy about because I didn't need that, you know, that hassle.
That's what's bringing you joy, really, isn't it? It's making decisions around what do we want in our lives and what's not so important, so that he could make decisions that he was happy with.
Exactly. And, you know, the overarching benefit to both of our lives, you can't even quantify it. He is so much happier because he's now not working in a job where his boss would frequently ask him to do illegal things with money.
Oh God.
And so to not have that pressure and to not have to go into work every day and think, what are they going to get me to do now that is going to go against my ethics? But also I'm a people pleaser. So how do I juggle those two things?
How do I say no?
He's happier. I'm happier. Our relationship improved hugely as a result of that because we didn't have one, usually two, cranky, frustrated, grumpy people in the house all the time.
Yeah. And that just adds to the stress, doesn't it?
Oh, it does.
Because you're not rested when you come home. You're not coming home to a sanctuary. You're coming home to a minefield.
Exactly.
The things that nobody's really happy about.
And if you need to have difficult conversations, and all relationships, there's times when you need to have difficult conversations.
Yeah.
You're not coming at them from a safe place because you're cranky and you're grumpy and you're sleep deprived and you're stressed.
Yeah.
Which means that difficult conversations are not going to have usually a positive outcome.
Well, I think it's very hard to keep them on the straight and narrow. You know, I think when you bring, because you're bringing a lot of emotion and stress and angst to them before you've even started.
Open your first mouth.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Exactly. Open your first mouth.
Yeah, your first mouth.
Before the first person opens their mouth.
Yes. Okay, so look, just to sort of round this off, because I mean, we could talk all day about this stuff. Mm. I think it's so important and so interesting. Can you give us three things you would recommend people do if they're feeling overwhelmed, if they're feeling under a lot of pressure? Are there three things you would say, start with these?
Yeah, look, the first thing I always say is if you haven't had gone to the doctor for a general checkup for more than a year, do that.
Right.
Because stress has huge physical health ramifications, usually which we don't realize until it's too late. You know, it can elevate your blood pressure and it can cause a whole lot of other horrible things to go on. And so make sure that that's okay. And that was, you know, for me, that was the reason, that was why, how I found out that I was not well, was my blood pressure was through the roof when I was in my 20s. And so if I hadn't looked after that, then who knows what would have happened. My doctor said I was heading for the worst.
Right.
The second thing I think it's really important that you do is figure out what is really important to you. What are your priorities? And pick one that you can start to focus on immediately, but that will give you a positive benefit in terms of your energy or your time or where you're putting your attention. And then the third thing is do something every day that you love. Do things that give you joy every day. Try to laugh every day. Try to have pockets of happiness every day. You know, when you figure out what your priorities are, then that will help you work out what can give you joy every day. And, you know, the two things I do every day or nearly every day are walk on the beach and read for pleasure. And I don't get to do them all every day. I don't get to do them both every day, but I do at least one of them every day. And I look forward to those things that I can, when I do them, and they just calm me and make me feel happy.
I totally agree. And I think with that last, with pockets of happiness, I think that can feel difficult to start with because it can feel self-indulgent.
Oh,
and the reality is you've only got to do it a couple of times.
Yeah.
And you get that sense that this has become a really important part of your routine and what you need to do.
That's it. And if you do,
sanity.
And you know, over the summer, if you're on a work break now and for a few weeks, then now is a really good time to start embedding some of those habits.
Yes.
So that when you do go back to work, you've seen the benefit of doing things that you love every day, and you are much more likely to try to embed those in your days going forward. And, you know, if they're things that take a bit of time, then you might need to shorten it, or maybe do it every second day and find something else to do on the other days. But start healthy habits when you're on holidays. I always find that they then are far easier to continue with because you've seen the benefit.
Yeah. I agree. Yes. And you've got the time and the headspace to focus on what can be difficult. Mel, thank you so much. I really appreciate you talking with us. And as I said, Mel's book, Fully Connected, is available on her website, and we'll put all the details in the notes for this episode. And hopefully, Mel, we can talk again at some point, because I've really enjoyed your insights.
Thanks, Juliet. I'd love to. And thanks so much for having me here. And any of your listeners, if you have questions, if I can help with anything, please get in touch. My contact details are all on my website, including absolutely. LinkedIn and Instagram.
Perfect. Thanks very much, Mel.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for joining us on this episode. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave us a rating, comment, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to recommend us to a friend. We also love hearing suggestions for topics or guest speakers that you would love to hear from. The best way to reach us to give us those suggestions is over on our Facebook page. Simply head to Facebook and search Grow Your Influence. See you there.